And I've got very angry, actually, about the way that men are just lumped into a sort of bin and described as toxic. And I think there's no salvation for masculinity in that. It's not helping people.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred.
My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values. We are in a special series themed around my book, Fully Alive, which means every episode I went looking to interview a guest who could help me think through one of the seven deadly sins, which is the frame I use to organize my chapter. In this episode, I spoke to Luke Turner, who is a music journalist, the co-founder of the Quietus music website, and the author of two books, Out of the Woods and Men at War. And we discussed particularly Out of the Woods, which is a memoir that touches on themes of sexual compulsion and bisexuality. And as you can imagine from the theme of lust, we would advise caution listening around children because there's some quite adult themes. And I also wanted to let you know that Luke touches on some early sexual experiences. There are themes of child exploitation and sexual abuse, which you should know about so you can decide whether to listen or not. It's not explicit, but it is there. There are some reflections from me at the end, as usual, and I really hope you enjoy listening. Luke, I am going to ask you something that I'm just beginning to ask people as our kind of let's get deep, fast question. And that is, what does fully aliveness mean to you?
I have been thinking about this quite hard since you gave me that hint that you'd be asking me this question. And that's quite a diving board into the deep end, a bottomless end, deep end, I think. And I've been really thinking about that because I feel like that's, I'm not sure I'm going to know that until more of my life is done and possibly nearer the end of it, which is quite a morbid way to start. But I was really thinking about that. But I think it's something I can only feel on reflection. I'm not someone who's particularly good at living in the moment all the time. I'm sort of beset by worry a lot of the time and self-doubt. So I find it very hard to find aliveness, fully aliveness. I have since having a little boy, this is probably a little cliched and maybe twee, but since having a child, when I'm with him, I feel extremely alive and fully alive on those little intimate moments where you just kind of go, rah, together. Mm. Or when I'm giving him a cuddle to get him to sleep, or taking him to a steam railway, which he loves. I feel very fully alive then. I feel it often with my family now these days, which is really lovely. Mm. And I feel it doing the things that I no longer have time to do because I have a child, like fishing, cutting down trees in Epping Forest, things like that. And I used to feel it in a lot of actually quite unhealthy pursuits, a lot around sex, actually did make me feel fully alive, which is why I think that they're quite complicated aspects of aliveness. Aspects of sex and sort of sexual, maybe overindulgence is the way to put it.
Yes, it's one of the things that we won't talk about much because we're going to focus on the theme of lust later in this conversation. But in the chapter in the book I have coming out on gluttony, I reflect a lot on addiction and how actually often it is, Nick Cave says in his book, you know, his heroin addiction was about a hunger for more, depth, you know, and that's what he's also looking for in religion, you know, that more beyond the banal, beyond the quotidien, you know, intensity.
Yeah, exactly. That's something I very much relate to. I feel like I've spent most of my life looking for quite extreme sensation or a feeling of perfection, that something is going to be so overwhelming that everything else doesn't matter. And I think you could do that in a lot of things. Definitely in extremely loud music. I've found that nightclubs, mind altering, I suppose, drinking to an extent, things like that. And I think that is a quest. So some people just have a hunger for escape and shutting themselves down, maybe to try and escape to something else. And that's something that, you know, I'm always teetering on the edge of working out where I sit in that.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about your values, because I think those two things are maybe related, but I'm not sure. I'm just kind of working out how these two things work together. Having listened to The Sacred a little bit, I think, what do you think are your deep guiding principles?
I mean, I think all of my deep guiding principles are from Christianity and my family. And I realize that now with, and I'm very happy about that. You know, I was brought up in a very Christian family. My dad was a Methodist minister. My mum is a very keen Christian. And that surrounded me since I was born. I've never known anything else. You know, I absorbed it fully. And I was never able to reject it. And therefore, I feel like it has utterly shaped me. And it's why I find Tom Holland's writing about the kind of the way Christianity has shaped everything in our society very interesting, because I feel like what the society, I feel like that as a human individual. In the same way I think our society is shaped by it. And I suppose I've tried to, you know, my day job is being a music journalist, and I slightly feel like, and lots of music journalists and people don't like this way of doing it, but I'm definitely a bit of a preacher in what I do. I have these artists who I love and I will bang on about it endlessly. And, you know, I'm a lot more tolerant of things I don't like now, but I used to very much have a pantheon of sinners and as much as of saints.
Hellfire and damnation.
Oh, yeah, I've rained hellfire and damnation on quite a few artists over the years. Some of them, to be honest, utterly justifiably. they deserved it. Some possibly less so, and it was just a sort of exercise in cruelty writing it. But I do feel that that sort of Christian value system has impacted even how I do that. And I think in my other writing, in writing about books, that value system is kind of like a Christian humanism, I think, shapes everything I've done. It's interesting. I come from my mum's side of the family. We're in the Plymouth Brethren, and they have, you know, very strict kind of orthodox Christianity. And it's probably to a lot of them or people on that wing of Christianity or the evangelical wing, it's a sort of maybe not particularly Christian values, but it's my interpretation of them. But I'd say I can't really escape that shaping of Christianity throughout how I try and live.
Yeah. So tell me a bit more about your childhood. Paint me a picture. I know you were born in Yorkshire, but ended up moving Essex Way. Is that right? What was little Luke's, maybe in your primary school years, what would we have seen if we'd dropped in?
Primary school, yeah. Well, I mean, it up north, I loved it. I was a very happy kid. We lived in Halifax. I was born in Bradford, don't remember that. But then we lived in Halifax. Dad was minister at St. Andrew's Methodist Church, really beautiful building in Halifax. And I just remember that strong feeling of the north being friendly and nice, and it had hills and all the houses were built of stone and everyone was jolly and funny and lovely. And I remember about 8 or 9, and we moved down south to St. Albans in Hertfordshire, which It was quite a jolt for me. I used to have quite a strong northern accent, and that went very, very fast. You know, and life was very much built around church. It was Sunday school, always people round for tea, you know, like the smell of tea is just so ingrained into my senses. You know that churchy smell of after church tea, and then also the
sound
home
of an
groups
urn bubbling.
Yeah, exactly. The really lethal urn in the corner spouting away. Large teapots. I'm quite obsessed with municipal teapots. I even wrote about them in the second book. So I think a lot of them were probably made from melted down Second World War aeroplanes. And then the kind of like the hum of voices downstairs from church evening groups and tea, massive trays of tea. You know, my parents have got a ludicrous amount of mugs from that. So that was a sort of very happy church childhood, really. And I guess that it's just that thing when you get older, and you know, when I was sort of probably 11 or 12, starting to really think about, well, feel sexuality in a stronger way, and then going to an all boys state school that was pretty tough. And very, you know, 90s masculinity was pretty, I mean, I don't like the term toxic masculinity these days, but I think then I really felt that I didn't fit in. And I just felt this sort of sense of alienation from many things, really, from church to an extent, from even from family. I mean, it's all normal stuff teenagers go through. You're trying to sort of separate yourself, aren't you? But I think the sexuality element and then religion, which had always been this huge comfort for me. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I used to do sermons. I would do little orders of service and do services for the family, you know, and I wanted to be a vicar like Dad and all of this sort of stuff. And suddenly when I was a teenager, all of that came up in opposition to this sort of growing confusion about sexuality and feeling of sin and things that were slightly frowned upon, like music and swearing in music and so on. I was kind of finding an allure in. Yeah. So that's the sort of potted childhood history, this sort of, you know, utter contentment, to be honest, through to this, you know, I was a preacher's kid, so we never had any money. You know, that's something we were very poor growing up. I didn't have Star Wars toys, didn't have fancy trainers, didn't go on holiday. So we were always a bit weird. You know, there was always that sense of difference, like, if you're a preacher's kid. And I actually really liked that. I sort of thrived on that. Secondary school, Dad came and did a service for the entire school in St. Albans Cathedral. And I was a bit awkward about it, but then he was brilliant. And I even put on my first music business thing I ever did was put on a Christian gig at secondary school. This band called Why with a question mark. I don't know if people might have heard them. Kind of sounded a bit like The Levellers. And I put a Christian gig on. I was so very happy being open about my faith and so on. But it was this sort of, the sexuality thing just started eating away at myself, because I inherited all the stuff about sin and the things around in some of the Christian magazines that were probably knocking around at home, that focus on the family, stuff like that, just started gouging away at my sense of self.
And how related do you think that is to the fact that you were exploring what I think you'd probably now describe as bisexuality? Do you think if it had been a more, you know, if it had been the sexual awakening that everyone has, it might have been less alienating? Or do you think that that sense of actually becoming a man, becoming that separation from your parents, might have happened anyway?
That's a really interesting question, because I think I didn't, I mean, there was like the no sex before marriage and all of that. And I was always been like, yeah, but people in biblical times were really young when they got married. This rule's kind of mad. And I remember Crusaders. I went to Crusaders on a Sunday afternoon, and we did, you know, this, I'm a bit rusty on the Old Testament, but there was a bit where, like, David sticks a tent peg, or gets someone to stick a tent peg through someone's head so he can have it off with their wife. And I was kind of like, it is a bit weird, this no sex before marriage. So I don't think it would have been as toxic. It was the kind of the feeling of, I mean, it wasn't just religion, I need to stress that. It was this sort of homophobia of society at the time, and AIDS. You know, that was this thing, like, gay people get AIDS, and this is what is going to happen to you. And, you know, school was really homophobic. There was no out, and, you know, 900 pupils a year for 7 years. There was not a single out gay kid in my school. It even got called up for homophobic bullying 2 or 3 years ago. You know, still not really changed. So I think it was this confused sexuality. And then, you know, bisexuality wasn't really present so much in culture. I didn't really know about David Bowie or James Baldwin or any of these people. So it was all like, am I just a repressed homosexual? I can't. What is this thing that I'm feeling? But I still like women, but I like men. Am I just so repressed by religion that I'm deluding myself that I can be in a relationship with a woman? And, you know, maybe if I reject religion, I can be a fully gay man or whatever. It was just this constant. And it's only now I can sort of rationalize those arguments. At the time, it was just this sort of feeling of hopelessness and being very lost. And there was no one to really talk to about it. So it was definitely the sexuality, the confused sexuality side, but it was, you know, it was religion and society and I've never solely blamed religion, Christian doctrine for it.
Yeah, it's really, your book is very nuanced about the various pressures on you as a teenager that made working out what a man was, let alone what your sexuality was, incredibly different for aspects of gay culture, aspects of just the presentation of masculinity, aspects of what you were hearing in religious culture. And I'd love to hear just a little bit more about that masculinity part, because it's a thread in so much of your work. You know, how do we think about what a man is now? How do we, what are the stories that we're telling? And it really struck me how much you're, all the way through, I can sort of hear you as a child and teenager trying to work out what box you fit in, right? You hated PE, but actually quietly you really liked football. But in music land, you aren't supposed to like football because that's not cool. And, you know, yeah, you're really into the war and soldiers, but then you're queer. So is that okay? And were there any queer soldiers? And what does it mean? What now, like having spent a long time thinking this through, how do you reflect on that time and the way we think about maleness?
Well, I think back then it was just so binary. It was like you're a lad and you like football and you're like kind of being crude about girls. You, being gay is not part of your world. If you're gay, you might be camp. There's a different cultural thing. You definitely can't be gay and be into football. I was very into the war. Into the war, it just sounds really wrong, doesn't it? But yeah, I was fascinated by the war and built model aeroplanes and all that sort of stuff. And then when I got to being a teenager, and particularly around the Euros in 1996, when all the jingoism of like the two world wars and one world cup coming up and all this sort of anti-German sentiment, that really made me think that my interest in the war was toxic and that belonged to those men. And it's been in the past sort of 5-10 years of just getting, actually as a reaction, to be honest, to some of the conversations around toxic masculinity in inverted commas, and kind of going, oh, actually, but that's who I am. I am a cis man. I think my gender identity was more confused when I was younger. You know, I used to wear ladies' blouses and a bit of makeup and kind of, you know, I had sort of borderline anorexia for a while. I didn't like eating and I was pretty thin and I was trying to remove sort of, you know, I'm quite a broad-shouldered, tall bloke really. And I was trying to get away from that. But as time's gone on, I've kind of become more comfortable in that male bodily identity. And I've got very angry, actually, about the way that men are just lumped into a sort of bin and described as toxic. And I think there's no salvation for masculinity in that. It's not helping people. We can see that. I think that conversation is pushing people directly to the manosphere and people like Andrew Tate. And so I started really thinking about how I related to masculinity. And, you know, football is a great example, really. I was, you know, dad's a West Ham fan. West Ham are one of those teams where you're never going to be particularly good. I inherited this burden off him. And I was very into football. Not to kind of like posters on the wall level, but I followed it all the time. And then again, Euro 96, all that lad culture jingoism just put me off it. And I was a closet, you know, I was very open about sexuality from the age of about 18, but I was a closet West Ham fan, closet football fan. And then, you know, recent years, just kind of exploring, thinking about masculinity, I got back into it and I found the Pride of Irons, who are the West Ham LGBT group, who were amazing. And then I realized that, you know, you could be queer and into football. And the sexual and gender identities of the people in that group and the back, you know, to me, it's almost like a church thing, Pride of Irons. There's people from all walks of mm-hmm. life, you know, very working class people, ponces like me who write things and are film producers and things like that. There's people of every spectrum of sexual identity and gender identity. And it's amazing. And actually, the way Pride of Irons operates can, I think, teach the world a lot about how we deal with masculinity, because everyone works hard to be accepting, and there's none of this sort of reflex judgment and casting people out, which I feel tends to happen when we're around masculinity these days. So, you know, I think I've found a male identity again, which I lost as a teenager, and I find that a really positive thing. Though I do feel that men are under attack at the moment, possibly justifiably so after, you know, centuries of dominance and so on, and the behaviour of a minority and so on, and the people like Andrew Tate. But I'm very wary of the sort of the constant attack, because as soon as you start feeling defensive, and I do think this is probably a male trait, you tend to go on the attack. But I can feel that urge in myself, and it's a difficult thing to sort of control sometimes. But I think it's very complicated. But I think we need to start seeing masculinity as a lot more complicated than we do. And there's a beautiful thing. You know, recently I've been going to a lot of model railway exhibitions and steam train things with my little boy. And it's been, I find those spaces fascinating. They're almost like a safe space for me now, to use the vernacular. These very male spaces. When I used to find them threatening, I mean, I used to cross the road to avoid football fans, or get off a train to avoid football fans. And now if I go to see West Ham, I kind of feed off that energy and feel it in a completely different way.
How much, as I was reading your book, I was writing copious notes in the margins because I found it so thought-provoking. And one of the things that that I was at least narrating it to myself in your kind of teenage years and your early 20s was that there was a model of masculinity that was a straight man, and there was a model of masculinity that was a gay man, but you were bisexual, which neither had high visibility nor fitted easily in those categories, and indeed carries quite a lot of stigma with it. Have you just relaxed into not needing there to be a box for that, that there are men and they come in all different shapes and sizes?
Yeah, I did feel that everything was in boxes before. And now, you know, like, I think sexuality is on the spectrum, and I think gender identity is on a spectrum, and there's a lot of grey area. I'm always fascinated by grey areas, and I think we exist within those grey areas. And if we're allowed to exist in them, which is hard because society does want to push you into boxes, then that's, you know, we talk about aliveness. I think that's where you can feel... You can feel that, you know. I feel that sometimes when I go to West Ham and we're all singing "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles." You've got 60,000 people singing that, and I know that around me, men who possibly all do present a certain way, like there's a lot of like Peaky Blinders hats and so on. But I know that out there are the Pride of Irons men or trans men and women and lesbians and trans women, and we're all there as part of this whole. And I find that incredibly beautiful. If we're talking about aliveness, that's where I feel it, because it feels quite subversive in a way that we're all there and we're all present within this thing that people, and particularly West Ham, who have a reputation, you know, of being quite a right-wing, intercity firm, football violence sort of club, that we're all, within this 60,000 people in the London Stadium, there is this absolutely beautiful, diverse array of masculinities going on. And I think that's really wonderful. And when I'm feeling optimistic, which isn't very often, I kind of think we're moving more in that direction. And if we could just sort of push through this sort of, against these reactionary people who are, let's face it, older and possibly not going to be around to inflict their judgment on the rest of us, then we can reach a better place for masculinity, where these boxes are broken down and we can live in grey areas in a more beautiful way.
I want to ask you about another element of your teenage years that is potentially very painful. So it goes without saying, say what you're comfortable with, but I'd love you to just sketch in the topic you come to reasonably late on in the book, which is experiences of what you would now call abuse or sexual exploitation, but didn't quite know how to understand at the time. Are you comfortable just saying a little bit about that?
Yeah, I felt it was very important to have it in Out of the Woods because it was very formative for me. And also, it was I basically had fumbly teenage experiences with a friend at school, which were high risk and strange in lessons. But then there was also this sort of seeking out or putting myself in the position where I was sought out by sort of grim old, not older, old men in public toilets and things like that. Which, you know, was, for years I used to brush it off and make a joke out of it. I've always had a sort of fairly bracing sense of humor. I used to say I was performing care in the community for the OAPs and things like that. And it, you know, I still find there's a slight amusingness to that, but it's actually really bleak and sad, you know, trying to justify it in that. And, you know, there is a bit, it's very icky in gay culture because I think it's one of the things that gay culture doesn't like confronting, doesn't like looking at in its recent history, the kind of connection between teenage boys and older men. You know, I'm not talking about 18, I'm talking much younger. And it was seen as part of the culture almost. You can see in all the research I've done for both books, it's present throughout 20th century gay history, and obviously before. And I think it's a bit taboo to kind of critique it in some ways, but I was very vulnerable and it was exploitative and those situations brought me a huge amount of shame, self-loathing, but were also very addictive. They were high adrenaline, high reward, highly exciting. They felt subversive because I'd be like, you know, everyone at school, you know, you think I'm a geek, but look what I'm really doing. I've spent a fortune on therapy talking about this. And, you know, it's been very interesting. My therapist is, you know, not religious, not a Christian at all or anything. And she says, you know, I wasn't very much of a rebel at home. You know, I wasn't the kind of kid who was going, boom, 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 or anything like that. And she said, this was your rebellion, but you had to keep it secret because you loved your parents and you had the framework of religion that you didn't want to upset. So your rebellion was very secret, which I think is very interesting. But yeah, that was, you know, they were very life-shaping things. I still, you know, there's still the consequences of that, which I've written about in the books. But I think this stuff is a lot more prevalent than is realized. The statistics for, you know, unwanted touch, as it's called, are pretty horrific. It's a, you know, a not insignificant minority of people have experienced that. And I think maybe with Me Too, I think maybe the women talk about it more, but it's still so taboo among men to speak about it. I think I understand why a lot of gay and queer men don't want to talk about it, because there is that association by the right wing and homophobes between paedophilia and homosexuality that is used to justify homophobia. And I can see why there's a men, gay people in queer culture don't really like discussing it. I think it's fair to say that exists in straight culture too. It's just not weaponized in straight culture against the men who are doing that. I think it's probably more widespread. Women have had to suffer that as girls and young teenagers more than men have. But and obviously for a lot of straight men, it'd be deeply shameful and something they want to lock down. Some people could brush it off. They go, oh, it was part of, you know, I learned a lot, you know, it was my induction into gay life or whatever. And that's fine if they've been able to deal with it. And it took me a long time to sort of understand how it had been damaging for me. And I do think it's one of these things we really need to have a more honest an open conversation about as a society. You know, pedo demonization is a popular British pastime. And I think there's a more complicated conversation to have about cycles of abuse and how those perpetuate and how to break them and how therapy is important and so on.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Luke. And I really found the way you wrote about it so compassionate, and yeah, your awareness, because the as you said, when I heard you do an interview where you said, I thought I'd written a book about Epping Forest and I realized I'd written a book about sex and death, and I was like, writing about sex is really sensitive. It's one of the areas I think that goes deepest into our sense of self. It's the easiest place to trigger shame or a sense of being judged, and therefore to trigger people into defensiveness. And as you say, and I can hear you wanting to write about your experiences with sexuality and abuse and sexual compulsion, but again and again having to say, because that wasn't life-giving for me, doesn't mean I think you're a terrible person. All of that. As you realize you were writing a book about sexual compulsion and about all of these things that are coming out, did you feel scared about some of the things you felt you needed to say, to be honest?
I think I was very worried about the impact on my family and my parents and what they'd think. I was scared of the judgment of not the people you might expect. You know, I've kind of lived with the feeling of religious judgment or conservative judgment my entire life. Culture was my safe space away from Christian conservative judgment. It was the place where taboos were broken, where you could say anything, where you pushed boundaries and visited extremes. In recent years, I felt that, well, not obviously Christian judgment, but the judgment has crept into the cultural world. And there's now a morality and a set of values, in particularly in the cultural world I exist in, maybe that sort of the bit of pub literature I'm in, or nonfiction, and certainly in the music world I'm in, there's a morality from the other side. And I was quite worried about, in Out of the Woods, being judged for what I was saying about sexuality and the complexities of the abuse systems. I was, you know, I had similar concerns in Men at War, which is a very different kind of book, but because I wasn't writing a Britain is bad, the history is bad, these people were bad, you know. And so I feel that, you know, I do find it's one of the things that really I find most difficult in the contemporary moment, is this feeling that this cultural world that was my safe space, a lot of the judgment and moralizing and moral values and saints and sinners and people being cast out with no forgiveness, cancel-y. I'm always arguing with my friends who say cancel culture doesn't exist, and I think it does. I don't think it exists for Harvey Weinstein or some of the big people, but I think people on a lower level very much are removed for infringements or perceived infringements of a moral code. Some of them possibly justifiably, but I don't like the way there's no way back. And that's where I find Christianity to be a lot more, to be, you know, increasingly appealing, counter to this, because it does have a way back. There is salvation and redemption and forgiveness. And I find that very difficult at the moment. It's even like I get afraid of saying this, because then you're suddenly like, it's beyond critique. Sometimes the current sort of cultural moment where there is a sort of moral judgment. Do you like it? You know, is your music collection ethically sound? You know, are the books you read ethically sound? Are they diverse enough? I just hate this idea that we're judged on the appreciation of culture. You know, culture saved my life. Art, music particularly saved me, really, really did when I was a teenager. And the idea that now some of it might be sinful, you know, is the word I go to straight away, and I can be judged on it. It's like, oh, this is where I came for salvation, and now it's been rejected. So I was, you know, with all of that in mind, writing both books, I was afraid of judgment.
It was funny because there's a line where you say, I thought there was something wrong with me because I didn't feel angry at my parents. And you're very honest that, you know, there are points when you're exploring your sexuality that your mum does, you know, hold a traditional position on sexuality, at least at points in your story. And that's painful and caused difficult conversations. But what comes through is the love. Like, I have probably never read a book that is more loving. It made me cry a lot. I was just like, oh, Lord, let me be as good a parent as Luke's parents were to him, because even though there was this big, hard, dark thing that you were wrestling with, you have this line at the end, you said, you know, it was their great gift of love that in the end helped me save myself. And the like, I can hear you being like, I'm supposed to be cross about this. I'm supposed to be angry with them. And I'm not. And I'm just going to be honest about that.
Yeah. I think a lot of books like Out of the Woods, you end up with quite a lot of anger towards the parents. And I never, you know, I could hear an argument that you were just a coward. You know, you should have been angry. It would have helped you to be angry. But I never could, because everything was done with love. And, you know, they've not read Out of the Woods, but I sort of asked them not to. And I wasn't sure about that for a while, but then I was like, that since I've had a son, I'm like, God, if he writes a book, a memoir, even if it hasn't got half that stuff in, I don't want to read it. That's his life. You know, it's a different thing. They both read the second book, not the first one. And I'm very happy. They kind of know what it is because they've read all the reviews and that lots of their friends have read it. But it was interesting when I was writing, it's like, how much do I put in? Am I letting them off? Almost. But then I was like, no, this is an honest reflection of how they are and how they are very loving. And, you know, that, I know they prayed a lot around sexuality and have their views have changed over the years. And I'm really proud of them for that. I know, you know, in when dad came into conflict with aspects, members of the LGBT Christian community, and he sat and prayed with them to try and find a meeting space. Sorry, I find this stuff quite, it kind of sets me off as well.
We can have a cry together, it's all good.
But this is the thing, because this is the deep, you know, it is this sort of tense zone, you know, when you get that kind of and then it makes you cry. But in a way now where it's actually, you know, we had arguments about it. We had a lot of rows, you know, and I think as you point out in your book, just the thousands of bits of the Bible, which are about money versus how much is about sex. And that was the thing for me. Like when, you know, I was never able to, you know, in the end, anger with my parents is also anger at God. That the two are entwined. I had, like I write in the book, I had three parents, God, mum and dad. And my lack of anger at my parents is also a lack of anger at God. I probably have tried atheism or tried to conceptualize atheism or to think, is atheism possible for me? And I think a lot of my friends, the vast majority of whom are total atheists or at best, agnostic, think I'm a bit weird because of it. But I find anger at God very, very strange concept. I get it. It's almost a bit obvious. It's a bit, you know, old man shouts at crowd, atheist shouts at cloud. You know, that's to me, like the kind of, that's what I feel like when I see people ranting about religion. So the anger at my parents would have been anger at God as well. And if I did feel that, I've processed it and I've dealt with it. And all I felt from my parents and from the Christian faith when it is love. Because I think it's very easy to go, if people are being hateful and justifying with Christianity, I can very simply go, well, that's a perversion of the faith. It's not hard for me to sort of look at the teachings of Jesus and go, well, what they're saying is complete nonsense. I've never had that problem. I just see people are the problem. It's not the system that's the problem necessarily.
Yeah. So it, you know, we've both just demonstrated how tender these topics can be. And I'm really grateful for you being willing to talk to me in general, because I've really loved your work, but also because I wanted to talk to someone about the Christian sexual ethic. And I wanted to talk to someone different from me, because I am like a weirdo outlier in that I didn't have sex before I got married and have a very satisfying sex life with one person. And one of the things I wanted to write about in the book is there's not a lot of presence in culture for that story as anything other than like poor repressed woman who has not explored her full self. And I had a similar thing with you in that every so often I'd question myself, be like, am I repressed? Am I missing something? Like, this script doesn't quite fit my life. I was single for a long time. I had these very kind of, this is going to weird some people out, like erotic adjacent experiences in prayer. Like my definition of what the erotic is bigger than just sort of, you know, genital contact. And so I have received the Christian sexual ethic as mainly very much going with the grain of my soul and going with the grain of my feminism. And what I see is the underlying principles about protecting the vulnerable and being extremely careful with power and refusing to treat other people as objects, as just in line with the rest of my theology, in line with my politics, you know, just making sense to me. But that was so out of whack with the broader story about what the Christian sexual ethic is and how harmful it is and those kind of things. So I was reading your book and these very different story from mine. I think it's, you know, you won't mind me saying, you have had a lot more sex than I have with a lot more people of all genders in all situations, all over the world. And you write about it in ways that are sometimes very funny, sometimes very kind of like joyful and sensual, and that you're having fun. And sometimes you're really clearly not having fun. And there's complexity there and shame and compulsion. You have read my attempt to write about the Christian sexual ethic. Given our such different life experiences in this area, what did it leave you thinking about? And if you radically disagree with me or want to push back on things, I would love to hear it.
No, I thought you were writing about was something I identified with, though the two things are very different. I think that idea around the values that shape the rest of Christian belief of not being exploitative, being respectful, and so on. I think that is possible whether you've slept with one person or many. You know, I don't think you're judgmental in the book as well, which is so important to hear a Christian voice being as open as you are in that. And I do find this the idea of erotic prayer, I thought that was amazing. I thought that was really interesting. So what, you know, why should the relationship with God not have a sensual physical element, or an emotionally sensual element? I think that's really interesting. And I think if you look at some of the, like you quote from in the book, some of the female mystics, there was something about that in there that's very interesting and very, very complicated. Almost like from your perspective, because I don't think you don't come across as repressed or whatever, because you write about those sort of erotic experiences and masturbation and fantasy and things like that. You bring that within a Christian framework, and that's, I think, very positive. My views around sexuality and Christianity are probably really far from the mainstream of Christianity and so on, but, you know, the Church of England was founded purely so King Henry VIII could go and shag another woman. I'm not, it's almost like when I sort of worked that out one day, I was just like, I'm not taking any lectures about whether my sexuality is immoral from these people. The entire church is, you know, there was other things going on, obviously, like Henry VIII wanted all the money of the monasteries and things like that. You know, it was such a sort of immoral foundation to the entire established church in many ways that I'm not taking any shit about my sexuality. Of course, you know, some of the things I participated in and subjected myself to were incredibly destructive. But that wasn't because they were sinful, because they were destructive. They were bad because they were destructive, and they're bad because they stop the aliveness. Mm-hmm. They end the feeling of aliveness. They separate, like you write through the book about connectiveness. That they remove that. But then again, it's two very similar situations that I might have been in around sexuality. One could have been, actually, I look back and it was fun, enjoyable, rewarding, funny. It's a story. It's something odd. I don't really have regrets, but something quite similar because of the dynamics of the other involved can be something that then comes back to be shameful and toxic, and I have to be careful about that memory. So I think it's very complex. And I can see that I did a talk at Greenbelt in the summer. Mm. And it was one of the most moving things I've ever done, was having a load of, obviously, trying to work out their faith and their sexuality, seeming quite queer, gender non-compliant, gender fluid, sexually fluid young people come up after, some of whom were kind of like to say thank you for saying that, because they were so conflicted. And I think it's a tragedy that the church often pushes people away in that way. And I've really found sort of engaging with One Body, One Faith very rewarding. I went to a service of last year, a service of atonement for kind of people lost to suicide, queer Christians lost to suicide, and it was a beautiful service. And that's been one of the rewarding things about writing Out of the Woods, is discovering this queer Christian world and queer clergy and a Christian sexual ethics, which is really beautiful and really powerful, and people with all sorts of different sexual identities and gender identities who are still able to be Christian. I think they're incredibly brave people. Because of that dichotomy, but I've always felt between faith and sexuality or masculinity and so on, I've never been able to be quite as forward as them, or even as you are, you know, the sort of the deep thought and prayer and so on. But I find that world incredibly inspiring. I really want to write about it, but of course, Britain's secular media is never particularly interested. They hate writing about God.
Maybe it's changing though, Luke. I think something's on the move. I want to finish by asking you about, you know, there's lots of ways that your story touches on divides and differences and some of the stigma around bisexuality and queerness. You have a particular line about how the public narratives about sex addiction specifically are always used when someone has been outed as a predator, and then they say, you know, I'm going to check into rehab for a little while to deal with my sex addiction. And you're rightly, I think, really angry about that you can find a behavior compelling or compulsive and not use your power to, you know, impose that on other people without their consent. And that your compulsive sexual behavior is, you know, fully consensual and with other people looking for that kind of casual sex. And it was really helpful for me to go, actually, what this podcast does, even though I think of myself as a reasonably non-judgmental person, and probably am sort of more than averagely open-minded, it helps me uncover layers of prejudice that I didn't know were there. And I think probably until I read your book, someone who was using Grindr and Tinder at quite the level that you were at periods in your life, I would have been a bit like, well... that is not my world, and those are not the choices I would be making. And have some, you know, I hope mild and compassionate, but some judgment, some judginess about why. And as you say, there for some people who that is pure is just like straightforward sex positivity, and it's a hobby, and you know, whatever it is. You know, I'm sure there are people who there must be some people, you know, all the studies show that some people have very high sociosexuality and all those kind of things. But to hear you really spell out that psychiatrists think that most people with sexual compulsions experienced early sexualization, i.e. abusive experiences in their childhood and teenage years, was one of those like, oh, Liz, you like, watch your heart. And I had a similar experience speaking to Clementine Morrigan, who also has dealt with addiction and homelessness, and a life just spiraled completely out of control, and was, you know, in and out of abusive relationships and work and with people who were in and out of prison and who were violent. And I don't think I ever would have consciously been judgy about her had I met her. But understanding just how traumatic her childhood was made me go, of course, my life would have looked like your life too. Like my stability and my impulse control and my, you know, access to resources and my strong attachment, these are all gifts and privileges which I did not deserve and have not earned, and that not everyone can access. And sorry, that was a real diversion into my world. But I guess my question is, for those who, like me, have not experienced sexual compulsion, perhaps have stories about people who have compulsive sexual behaviors or actual sex addiction, what would you like them to understand to help us build that empathy of other humans?
I mean, I do think it's, where does that behavior come from? I think it's almost like, well, one of the things I was slightly worried about with afterwards was making that connection between sexual promiscuity and abuse, because the sex positive movement doesn't, it kind of rejects that a bit. And mm-hmm. I've even spoken to people back in that time. Now, when I was writing the book, and I was single, and I was very interested in meeting people who were kind of similarly minded. And so many of them said things had happened when they were younger. And then some were like, but this is my way of dealing with it, and I'm fine with that. And that's, I respect that. I possibly because of the Christian framework, I couldn't have just gone, right, okay, that's it for the rest of my life. I'm just going to be rather keen on having sex with lots of people. But maybe it is because of Christianity, I couldn't do that. But that's fine. That's my story. So I think it's kind of like trying to understand what has created it. And then just, being non-judgmental. I think, I think Russell Brand is a sort of very interesting case with when we talk about sex compulsion and addiction. Because when everything came out about him, sort of, everyone knew that he was very into sex. He had lots of sexual partners. And then you read about his biography and his behavior pattern, and he is absolutely a sex addict who, I believe he was abused when he was younger. And I just think, what he did and the way he behaved is awful. Like, you read those accounts and they are grim. They're really grim. And he was obviously not able to process. And I think the only way to break those patterns is for the outside world to be non-judgmental and to listen to people who've been through these situations and to try and understand them. Because it's even with what I experienced when I talk to my therapist and, when we try and understand why I got it, did these when I was just such a nerdy teenager, I was a real, putting on Christian gigs at your school, into model aeroplanes, bullied on non-uniform day because I was wearing like crappy clothes or whatever. I was a real nerd. And then we look at why as this nerdy, innocent kid in a very loving family, did I go for these hyper-risky sexual situations as a young teenager? And the therapist would go through and we think possibly something did happen before, and that tends to hit me quite hard. And sometimes if I go there, there's a visceral physical reaction which can suggest something, a buried trauma or something, and that's something I'll always have to sort of process and deal with that in the past. I can't remember it, and obviously my therapist, being somebody who's a bit skeptical about religion, says, was there anyone in church? Churches were notorious as places where kids were abused. I can't place anything, but there is a feeling of something that why at 14 did I do these things that were so out of character? And, the psychiatrist analysis would be that because something had happened before and you're trying to recreate that feeling of comfort and excitement that unfortunately that sexualization brings. So with having lived through all of this and then worked on the compulsive behavior and so on, I just think it's very hard. I understand how it's hard for people, particularly Christians, to process these kind of, outre sexual behaviors. But I think if there's one way we can, that would be positive and helpful, is to just try and understand it and understand the patterns and understand that the only way people are going to be able to break those patterns, like you write in the book about forgiveness being such a powerful energy. And I think that forgiveness and understanding is the only way to sort of break these cycles and to help people. And to, if people are still want to be sexually promiscuous and that's their way of dealing with it, then I think we have to be, or try, we ought to try and be non-judgmental about it.
It feels to me like one of the most radical things my tradition offers, and one of the most offensive, is the claim that nothing is unforgivable and that everyone is redeemable. No act is like beyond the reach of salvation, and that every human heart is fragile and foolish, and we are all in need of grace. We are all in need of grace, I believe, from God and from each other. And that it's only when we approach each other with a posture of grace and the radical non-judgment that I think Jesus very explicitly says, judge not lest you be judged. That's the bit about Christianity that people find offensive right now, which is interesting.
Which is interesting, because that's the bit I'm increasingly drawn to, is Jesus's non-judgment. Someone, you know, like I say, I'm coming to, it's the biggest lesson I could learn from Jesus is to be less judgmental. And I have to fight it. My instinct is to judge the judges. Even my, atheist or, non-Christian therapist says, that's a judgment. You're making a judgment. And I was like, but they're being judgy. She said, you're judging the judge. You just end up in, and we're in a time, which is fueled by the dopamine and social media and the feeling of being in the in group, people like me. A concept you write about. We're in a time where people want to feel good and to have a in-group, even if, the problem with online is you can feel together with people scattered all around the world by judging other people. And I do find it very difficult not to judge the judges. And then, but it's very toxic. I feel that. So I get angry kind of like this because I'm angry about the way people are behaving like that.
I could have talked to you for a lot longer, Luke, but I'm very grateful for your time, your honesty, your reflections, and for being a guest on this special, fully alive series of the Sacred Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed that. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Luke said this lovely thing about when he feels fully alive with his son, with that deep connection of parenting. And my working theory of fully aliveness is connection with ourselves, connection with other people, connection with the natural world, and connection with the divine, with love beyond us. You will have a different working theory of fully aliveness, but it's interesting to me. It will be interesting to me to see as people answer this question, how much it fits within my frame or not, maybe. And Luke also really drew out something that I think is true for all of us, that sometimes the times when we feel most fully alive, we are doing things that are potentially a bit dangerous for us, going to the edges of what's healthy. And it's actually something I explore in the chapter on gluttony and on kind of numbing behaviors and addiction, and this sense that actually often in compulsive or addictive behaviors, we're looking for something more. We're looking for intensity. We're looking to feel fully alive. Nick Cave talks about chasing a very similar thing in his heroin addiction, as he's now feeling drawn to in his explorations with church. So I think that was an interesting thing to have drawn out and an important thing. It's lovely to hear Luke paint a positive picture of church. And honestly, when I picked up his memoir, I knew it reflected on themes of sexuality, which was part of the reason I wanted to read it and talk to him. I wanted to talk to someone really different from me, actually, in their experiences around sex, in their kind of understanding of this area of our lives. And I didn't know when I went in that Luke had been raised in church. And actually to hear a bit on this interview and also very deeply in the book, this beautiful, incredibly positive picture of the community that he was raised in and the enormous teapots and the mugs and being in and out of people's homes and the kind of socialism of that bit of Methodism and how that's formed him and his politics was just a really beautiful thing. And again, Luke manages to let two things be true, which is that being a queer person raised in that context came with its challenges, and it also left him with many blessings. And there's a lot of sadness about at the moment in that cross-section of faith and sexuality, and a lot of challenge, I think, and struggle as people try and navigate it from all different perspectives and all different directions. But the picture that Luke paints of his family, where they've built a lot of love and trust across generations and in seasons across real differences of opinion, was quite a heartening thing to hear about. I think Luke's really thoughtful on masculinity and on actually it's quite hard to be a man right now and to know what is okay and what isn't, and that some of the discourse around toxic masculinity can be quite unhelpful for making men feel sort of inherently bad in their maleness, and not knowing what would be a healthy or a healing or a liberatory vision of being a man in the world. I had a funny experience recently where I was helping lead an all-female walking group and someone got into trouble on the Southwest Coast Path, and we had to call the Coast Guard in. And I'd tried to carry this person and then other women who tried to carry this person. We eventually just got to the point of like, this is one of, another person's going to get injured if we do this. So we called the Coast Guard, who happened to be an entirely male team. There were 14 of them, came over the hill like the cavalry in two big trucks. It was obviously sort of great. But there was also something about the camaraderie and the competence and the care. And there was a lot of joking, a lot of banter, a distinctly kind of male energy. They're all farmers, had their own businesses as plumbers and electricians, which is why they can volunteer and drop everything to come and rescue someone on a cliff. And I'm sure if there were women Coast Guards, that they would have been very much part of that and great too. But I had the, I had this thought, whatever the opposite of toxic masculinity is, this is it. Competence and camaraderie and care and using their physical strength, which we actually really needed in that moment, to help people and to give up their time. Yeah, I want to think more about masculinity and the stories that we tell about it. Sex. Yeah. I was really nervous about this episode. I was really nervous about this chapter. I felt it was important to address it, to talk about actually an ethical lens on our sex lives. But classically, anytime you get near any sort of ethical lens on our sex lives, it very quickly can descend into judgment and shaming or finger pointing or, you know, there's history with this subject of us not knowing how to talk about it well. It's a very tender area. I was really grateful for Luke being very straightforward, very up for it, very thoughtful and very, very self-reflective about his own journey as someone who has had, it's not hard to have had more sexual partners than me, but really opposite end of the scale. And, you know, approached that area of his life extremely differently from me, and how he both wants to sort of name what's great in that, and how, you know, he says some of it was just really hot and really fun. But also the bravery, I think, and maybe takes a bit more bravery to talk about where it wasn't healthy or fun. And it really helped. It's not that I didn't know this, but it really landed for me, this idea that those who experience compulsiveness around their sexuality, who do not feel in control of their sexual behavior, are often people who have experienced early sexualization, which obviously most of which you would put under the category of abuse, and how complex that is to both have been exploited and harmed at a very deep psychological level, and because of the nature of arousal and illicit things. And, you know, Luke said, you know, he was the nerdy kid of a pastor at school, and yet he had this what seemed to him to be sort of a darkly glamorous side of his life. Yeah. Again and again, I'm like, do not judge. You do not understand someone's backstory. I also, again, found it really helpful for Luke to talk about how the music industry and that kind of culture, queer culture, being really sort of safe and freeing for him to express all these different elements of his identity. And now possibly a place where he feels a bit more nervous about being honest about his opinions. And it's the same thing with church, right? This is a particularity to our contexts, particularity to our moments, and our brain goes for binaries, right? If we're church people, maybe, you know, church, safe, wholesome communities, maybe slightly nervous of or feel distance from a kind of queer community or music industry community and see it as somehow threatening. Or if you are a queer person or in the music industry or in culture and that feels like your safe place, then the church maybe looks very sinister and off-putting and, you know, full of paedophile priests. And how helpful it is to just not rush to judgment and not think we know what's going on in other individual lives and other communities and other industries and other places. To be curious, to listen and see what we learn. I was really grateful for Luke to, just reflecting with me about my attempt to write about the Christian sexual ethic and what it might be. I'm not going to try and unpack that for you here because I wrote that chapter with more blood, sweat, tears, and care than anything I've ever written. If you want to know what I wrote, you can get hold of it, and I don't mind if you borrow it or go to the library. You never make any money from books anyway, so I would prefer it to be read. But if you're interested, that's where it is. I'm not going to try and summarize it. I guess I will end on something Luke said. He said there were some sexual experiences that were troubling, not because they were sinful, but because they were destructive. And the thread I'm trying to pull on around sin in general is, I think those are the same things. Like, I think if sin is a relational concept and about disconnection, then what's destructive? You know, it's a problem because it's destructive. It's destructive of our own relationship with our own soul and what it really wants, not what it is sort of addictively craving. Our relationship with other people, and yes, the relationship with the divine, but I know that language doesn't work for everyone, or you might not feel drawn to it. And I think the concept can help us anyway. But to have him say, not because they were sinful, but because they were destructive, I want to be like, I think I'm understanding sin differently from you when you say that. I think they're the same thing. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. Our production team are Dan Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Amari Yagandran. Our music is by Luke Stanley, and we are edited by Drew Hawley. And we are so glad to be a project of the think tank Theos, and we would love you to go and check out Theos's wider work. You can get in touch with me on all the socials, not all of them. I feel too old to be on TikTok. TikTok? So I can't even say it. TikTok? I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter, trying to be there less. You can follow my Substack. If you have read the book and would like to be in conversation about it, I would love to hear what you think. Please do leave reviews for that as well as the podcast. Don't forget to share it and review it. That's all from me this week. Speak to you soon.